This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Homelessness has become a chronic problem in America for decades, even through the good times. With the recession, it is getting worse. In good times and bad, there have been organizations here and around the country working to find solutions. And today we'll try to shed some understanding on why, despite efforts at the local and federal level, homelessness persists. And we look at some of what's being done here and around the country to get a grip on the problem. We're joined by Philip Mangano, President and CEO of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness. Prior to his taking that position, Mr. Mangano spent several years at the helm of the United States Interagency Council on Homelessness. He was appointed to that position in 2002 by then-President George W. Bush and remained there for the first 100 days of the Obama administration. Welcome to Charlotte.
Thanks so much. It's good to be here with you, Mike.
Thank you. And we're also joined in our Spirit Square studio by Caroline Chambray of Charlotte's Urban Ministry Center. Prior to joining Urban Ministry, Ms. Chambray was one of the directors of Common Ground in New York City and ran the largest permanent supportive housing project in the nation on Times Square. You may have seen it profiled on 60 Minutes. Thank you for being here and welcome to Charlotte to you as well. How long have you been here now?
I came back to Charlotte in May. I grew up in Charlotte, but haven't lived here for about 15 years, so it's been great to come home.
Welcome home. Speaking of home, does anybody know how long this homelessness problem has been with us, when it began? Can we pinpoint it?
Wasn't it Adam and Eve and they were thrown out of the garden?
That could be it.
Actually, though, I have to tell you, a number of years ago, there was an exhibit at the Museum of History in New York City. Mm-hmm. So I was fascinated to go because many of my friends in Massachusetts thought that it was literally when Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible to be sworn in, homelessness burgeoned in
our country. That's what I thought.
Right. And, of course, I went to this exhibit thinking in New York they would probably take that orthodox stance. In fact, that exhibit began chronicling homelessness in New York in 1686 and had in every century the manifestations of homelessness, so probably from our beginning.
But in truth, having grown up around the nation's capital, I don't remember as a kid seeing people sleeping on grates, on sidewalk grates, and until the Reagan administration. Did something happen at that period to increase the problem, or did something in the homeless population change? How did they suddenly become so visible?
In 1963, President John Kennedy, mm-hmm. in a move toward a more progressive look at mental health services, began the process of deinstitutionalization. Actually, he began that. People think that Ronald Reagan started it in California, but actually it was the most progressive view of how to deal with people who were in the horrible situation, the inhumane and often fetid situations in the back wards of mental institutions, and the idea was to reintegrate those people into the community. It was a three-legged stool to reintegrate. You need to have a place to live. Mm-hmm. You need to have the new psychotropic medications that, if taken, would allow people to live stable lives in the community. And then third, community supports to ensure that people were stable in their housing. Well, it's a three-legged stool that stands, but a two-legged stool doesn't stand, and we only provided two legs of the stool. We provided the place to live, often in YMCA, YWCAs, rooming houses, lodging houses, and the psychotropic meds, but did not provide those community support services. As a result of that, people eventually decompensated, that is, they didn't stay on their meds, and when they went off their meds, they lost their tenancies, and when they fell out of their housing, there were no institutions to catch them any longer. So when they fell to the street. That began happening wherever deinstitutionalization took place in the mid-1970s, literally all over our country. And that's the mid-1970s before Reagan was sworn in, actually.
Is that third leg of the stool what More Place does? You're the director of More Place here for Urban Ministry. That's what that does.
More Place, exactly. More Place will be 85 units of permanent supportive housing for people who are chronically homeless. Mm-hmm. And the key word in that is, well, two words, permanent and supportive. And the support piece is critical in helping people stay housed and helping them maintain stability and you know, reach toward self-sufficiency.
And we'll talk about the definitions of the various different kinds of homeless people. But the chronically homeless, mm-hmm. that you're talking about are the people that Mr. Mangano is referring to, the people who came out of institutions or perhaps need help, medical help for psychological problems. Is that correct?
They're basically people with a disability by virtue of mental illness or substance use or other reasons or sometimes co-occurring. Mm-hmm. They have multiple disabilities. have had long-term stays in homelessness. These are the folk that the research tells us. This is not conjecture and anecdote anymore. The research and data tells us these are the folk who are long-term homeless, and without some kind of intervention from the outside in their lives, they're going to stay long-term. They're going to randomly ricochet through very expensive systems of care, of health, law enforcement, jails, before judges. So they turn out to be very expensive in the community. And the idea is that for the other 80% of the homeless population, the research tells us they're going to get out of homelessness pretty rapidly, no more than about 47 days on average. They're going to get out. It's this 10 to 20% of people who are long-term homeless with a disability. Those are the folk who don't get out without some kind of outside intervention.
Is that where the focus of most of the agencies in Charlotte, including Urban Ministry Center, is? Is it focused on the chronically homeless, or is it focused on the situationally homeless people, maybe who are having financial problems, but they get out of it because of family help in 30 days or whatever it may
be? It's both. And that's where I think the agencies in Charlotte really try to work together and not to duplicate services, but for each agency to work on a specific area. And so Urban Ministry Center focused specifically on the chronically homeless, on the people who've been on the streets the longest. And then many people in Charlotte know Crisis Assistance. Crisis Assistance is really the lead provider for the situationally homeless, those 80% that Philip talked about, that really, you know, maybe they need help to stay in the housing that they already have, to, you know, pay late utility bills, get the next month's rent. Those people who they can get back into housing, they can get out of homelessness in 40, 60 days with a little bit of assistance, and they can navigate sort of the system and the assistance that's available to them in Charlotte. So that's really the focus of that agency. Urban Ministry really tries to focus on the hardest to serve.
The mission that you are of the organization that you are the CEO and president of, the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness, Mr. Mangano, is to be a strategic partner with every level of government as well as private and faith-based sectors. How long has the Roundtable been in existence?
Actually, it began when I left Washington. I had previously worked in Massachusetts on the issue of homelessness for about 23 years before the fateful call came where they wanted my Social Security number and date of birth so that they could whisk me off to Washington. And in my 7-plus years in Washington, we worked with mayors, county executives, governors all across the country, plus the private sector, and especially the business community. And that's one of the things I'm so encouraged about here in Charlotte, is the business community stepping to the table on this issue. We don't often think of the business community as being stakeholders on the issue, but it's precisely the mindset of the business community that is really reframing the issue from a social service frame where we thought about servicing homeless people, it's a good instinct, but never got the job done, to more of a business and economic frame where when you see homelessness, what you wonder is not how to service them, but how to solve people's homelessness. That's the direction that Charlotte is going. And certainly, More Place is part of that new approach. It's really bringing the future to Charlotte in terms of thinking about how do we actually solve people's homelessness? How do we move them off the street, out of long-term stays in shelters, out of the library, out of the police station, out of the emergency room, and place them in housing and provide stability? That's exactly what More Place is about.
Why are businesses involved? What's the stake for them?
Literally all across the country. Again, when I was in Washington, we worked with about 1,000 different communities around the country, which eventually those 1,000 communities fashioned 350 10-year plans. Those plans were all about putting the verb end together with the noun homelessness. And you can only do that if there are innovative ideas that get to the solution of homelessness. And the business community has a vested interest in the health of the community, the well-being of the community, to create a better business climate. But it's important for the issue of homelessness that the business community be involved, because they bring a different mindset to the issue. The gene pool of providers, which is a beautiful gene pool of good intentions and well-meaning programs, is not sufficient to create the kind of strategies that is the business approach is necessary to actually make a difference. So it's that business mindset that brings us to business principles and practices that bring solutions.
So people who are listening will know you were credited in many different circles for making enormous strides in ending homelessness over the last several decades. The San Francisco Chronicle says yours was the most aggressive nationwide strategy in a generation to solve homelessness. Democratic mayors around the country, and you were working for the Bush administration, Democratic mayors around the country, most of whom weren't terribly flattered or they didn't like the Bush administration very much, liked your policies. And the Washington Times said that you were the one person working overtime to bulldoze misconceptions about homelessness.
You've done your homework.
Thank you.
Getting all those quotes anyway.
So what were the misperceptions? What are the misperceptions about homelessness?
I think probably the most important one is that if good intentions, well-meaning programs, and humanitarian gestures could end homelessness, it would have been history decades ago. And yet we rely on those. We fall prey to what Einstein, Einstein said that the very definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. We kept doing that same thing, and we were met with a rising number of homeless people. It's only as we shifted away from the moral, spiritual, and humanitarian, though keeping a good grip on them, that's what brings most of us to this issue, and shifting to a more business and economic frame. And once we understood through, of all things, cost studies and cost-benefit analysis, many people say, what do they have to do with homelessness? Well, if you're trying to solve the problem, they have everything to do with it. In fact, I would say cost studies and cost-benefit analysis, those are other words for compassion for homeless people, because they've driven a political will toward solutions, toward things like more place.
Why? Because homelessness costs society too much money?
It's very expensive, and I know Carolyn has done some work in the urban ministry here in Charlotte, has done some work on this issue. So, Carolyn, you could talk locally, and then I'll give you a larger sense.
Okay.
I mean, I can give you, just to give you one statistic that I think people will find shocking. We did the Urban Ministry Center in partnership with the Charlotte Housing Authority and about a dozen other community agencies, and we had over 100 community partners. We did a week-long survey in February of called a vulnerability index, where we went out for over 3 days, and we surveyed as many chronically homeless individuals as we could find. There were willing to talk to us, and the majority were. And shockingly, we found 807 chronically homeless individuals in Charlotte. That number was staggering. That was, exceeded what the city thought it would be, what the county thought it would be. Over the course of that interview, we asked people how many times they had been to the ER in the last 3 months. Because if you're homeless, you're on the streets, things like having a cold, not feeling well, you don't have the option to call your primary care provider. So people end up going to the ER as their primary care. And what we found of the people that we surveyed, that there were a total of 1,157 ER visits over the last 3 months. That was a total of $1.2 million. That's a cost that was absorbed by the hospital system, by healthcare providers, and that's just one statistic in terms of the inordinate amount of cost that chronically homeless, needing healthcare, not having access to it, not having stable housing, how those resources, those community resources, get misused, and is just a misuse of public funds.
Yeah, your study, the Charlotte Vulnerability Study, uncovered the population of chronically homeless as 60% higher than previously thought. Is it because, is that because we never did a survey, never did a census, or we undercounted? Why is it so much higher than we thought?
I mean, I think there's a couple reasons. There is a point in time count that the city does do each year. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of cities don't necessarily focus in on that difference between situationally homeless and chronically homeless. So I think the survey that we were doing that comes out of Boston actually comes out of research from Dr. Jim O'Connell from Boston's Healthcare for the Homeless. I think that survey really asked the right questions.
Let me take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this problem with Caroline Chambray of Urban Ministry Center and others. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sardis Baptist Church, an inclusive congregation where women are pastors, children lead worship, and theological diversity is valued. 5811 Sardis Road or online at sardisbaptistcharlotte.org. And Johnson C. Smith University. This Sunday at 4, the Charlotte Symphony Orchestra and JCSU Concert Choir explore the effects of music on the human brain and body. Open to the public, jcsu.edu. America is a melting pot, and one place we find proof of that is in the pot, or the pan, or the oven. From the country's founding, our food has been greatly influenced by the people who have come to live here, from Italian spices to Asian cooking methods to south of the border influences, American food really is immigrant food. And we're going to meet tomorrow with noted food critic and writer Molly O'Neill. She shares her portrait of American cooking. Plus, we have some great news for foodies as well. That's tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, taking care of veterans now and in years past, the history of services for veterans, and the challenges of meeting the complex physical and psychological needs of those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan today.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 o'clock, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the problem of homelessness here and around the country. We just heard from Caroline Chambray, who's director of More Place and the Homeless to Homes Housing Program with Urban Ministry Center. And Philip Mangano joins us as well. He's president and CEO of American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness and the former director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness in the Bush White House. You were going to amplify what Caroline Chambray just said on a local level with some national figures here.
Well, first of all, I'm so proud of Urban Ministry Center for moving out and doing cost studies, because literally across our country what we're learning is that the old way of looking at the issue just wasn't working. And what is driving political will, what is driving civic will, is to do cost studies and cost-benefit analysis. And what's happened around our country is there are 65 different cities that have done cost studies, and then the follow-up to a cost study is finding out, when you do this intervention of housing like you're going to do with More Place, is that more expensive or less expensive than it costs for those folk to be randomly ricocheting through acute physical care and emergency rooms and police stations and courts and incarceration. Well, around the country, 65 cities have done these studies. And what they discovered was that the range of costs of the random ricocheting, in other words, people not having a place to live, so now they're going to the emergency room, the range of those costs was between $35,000 and $150,000 per person per year. And when they did the intervention of housing, they discovered that that intervention, which literally ends people's homelessness and creates a trajectory to a better life, those interventions cost between $10,000 and $25,000 a year. So you can spend $35,000 to $150,000 to maintain people in homelessness, to literally maintain them on the street or in shelters, or you can spend $10,000 to $25,000 to literally end their homelessness. Well, when you look at those two things, when mayors and county executives, when Mayor Fox has looked at that, and when Jennifer Roberts, who's your county commissioner, looked at that, it drives their political will, because you don't need to be Warren Buffett or even Susie Orman to understand which of those is the better investment. So that kind of approach, which actually solves the problem but is cost-effective and better for the taxpayer, that is now driving homelessness policy around our country. That's leading to solutions, and that's leading to the decreases we're seeing in cities literally all across the country, which Charlotte is about to join in through their 10-year plan.
Is this approach that you've been talking about the reason why you've said that the people who work in the homeless sector, trying to help homeless people, have gone from being demoralized to being remoralized, because there's hope now, but there's a different approach that actually seems to be working?
I don't think there's any question. Those of us who, and I did it in 1980, those of us who rolled up our sleeves, and I began volunteering on a bread line in Boston, the first one since the Great Depression. And if homelessness were a growth industry like energy or high tech, we were doing fabulously, because that bread line was growing incrementally every week, every month, every year. We started at 50 people, and it was 300 people after 2 years. So if it was a growth industry, it was fabulous. If it's a moral and social and spiritual wrong, which it is, then we were going in the wrong direction. We wanted to reduce the numbers and end it. So you can imagine how frustrated, even in our volunteer efforts, we might feel good handing out that sandwich and that coffee and sending people to a warehouse place where they would be warehoused for the night. But it was demoralizing over time. We were frustrated that we couldn't do better for our neighbors, because who are homeless people other than our neighbors? So we got, over time, you get demoralized that that's happening. And I can tell you, nurses in emergency rooms get demoralized seeing the same homeless person coming back, and police get demoralized, and judges get demoralized, and incarcerators get demoralized. And it's only with solutions that move people out of homelessness, that move them out of the emergency room, out of shelters, out of the breadline. That's where people start to get moralized about the issue.
You've been doing a lot of nodding, Caroline, as he spoke. Put your 2 cents worth in there.
The one thing that I can add is there's, in terms of being re-energized and not feeling demoralized, is that feeling when you hand someone a key to their apartment. And someone who's been homeless, we just moved two chronically homeless individuals. We added them to our Homeless to Homes program in September. And one person had been living in a tent camp for 4.5 years, a gentleman who's 60 years old. Another woman had been living on the streets for about 7 years, is HIV positive, has some other health issues. That moment when you give them the key to that apartment and you see the look in their face of, I'm not going to be sleeping under a bridge tonight. I'm not going to be sleeping in a tent camp. I can. And the week after they had been in housing, I saw both of them, and all I kept saying, and everyone kept saying to them, is, you just look rested. You just look rested. And they could. It was the first solid night's sleep I think either one of them had in years and years. And that is an incredible way to feel re-energized and hopeful.
If I can just say, I couldn't agree with Carolyn more. I've been with homeless people who've been homeless for years, sometimes a decade, when they literally put the key into the lock and unlocked that door and went in. If you don't cry at that moment, there's something wrong with you morally. You need a moral tune-up or something. But the important thing also is we don't need to idealize or romanticize homeless people. Many of them have terrible disabilities. Some of them have made bad personal decisions or been victims of bad public policy decisions, and their lives are kind of torn apart and rendered. So it's not only providing the key to go in, and that's exactly, again, what More Place will do. It'll be 85 of those keys, 85 of some of the people who have been on the streets here and are in the shelters the longest will no longer be there. They'll disappear from the streets and appear in housing. But we also know that people who are very vulnerable and disabled often need support services. So More Place is not only about providing the key to the door, it's about providing the support services that will help to sustain that tenancy and maintain that housing over time. So it's, as Carolyn said earlier, it's both the housing and support services. It's not just placing people in housing and thinking, well, we've done that, we're off to the next. That was the failure of deinstitutionalization. That's what led to pandemic street homelessness all across our country. We've learned just simply giving a person housing doesn't work. Housing without services sets people up for failure. But services without housing leaves them on the streets, leaves them in the shelter.
But if I remember your figures that you gave out a few minutes ago correctly, there are 807 chronically homeless, and 85, when More Place is done, will be serviced. That's 10%. That leaves 90% of the chronically homeless still underserved. Mm-hmm. How do you solve that problem?
More housing. And More Place, you know, will be the tip of the iceberg, and we're thrilled about providing a home for 85 people. We also do have another program called Homeless to Homes, where we house people in apartments in the community using a scattered site model, which is a model that is used in a lot of other cities.
How many of them want these homes? Because it is, I've seen stories on the news where some people just don't, they like being homeless. It was their choice to be homeless. They want to be homeless. They don't want to feel confined. They don't like the idea of having to report to somebody else. They want the freedom to be themselves, whatever that may be, and for whatever reason they may have. How many of them want this?
I would say they all do.
Really?
I really believe that. I do believe that. I believe.
Is it a matter of trust on some of their parts?
It's a matter of trust developing a trusting relationship with someone. We found that's key. When I worked in New York, I think that was the key, was outreach workers developing that relationship of trust with a person who'd been on the streets and a person who's seen a lot of disappointment in their lives and seen a lot of stops and starts and a lot of failures. And I think that for some people, when there's been that many failures in your life, it's almost easier to stay in what you know, which is in homelessness.
And frankly, in the past, our creativity didn't match the aspirations of homeless people. I've literally gone all over our country and talked to homeless people in other countries. When you ask a homeless person directly, not when they're in a group, not with a prompt list, but just one-on-one, ask them what they want, they never ask for a pill, a program, or a protocol. They ask for one thing, a place to live. And finally, our expectations as government and as provider agencies are matching the aspirations of homeless people. More Place matches what the consumer wants. If you ask, I mean, the basis of the American economy is you ask the customer, the consumer, what they want. Mm-hmm. They identify a product. You go out and create that product, bring it back to that person. Shockingly, they match up with that product. So if homeless people, if finally we're taking the time to actually talk to the customer, and they're saying they want a place to live, when we go out and create that place to live, people go in. There's a classic story in St. Louis where there were 97 people who were chronically homeless on the streets and in encampments. Everybody said that they prefer that. And even the people said, well, we prefer being here. And everybody was content in that. We finally said to people in St. Louis, this is when I was in Washington, take some of your money, go rent some apartments, bring a key out, and literally say to those people who seem intractably homeless, if you come with me now, this key will open up an apartment and you'll go in. In the 2 years that they've been doing that, 95 of the 97 people who seem to be intractable, who had quote unquote chosen that kind of life, they're now living in apartments. So sometimes it's our lack of creativity because we didn't use just basic business principles of asking the customer what they wanted in terms of what our response needed to be. So again, expectations shaped by the aspirations of homeless people. That's what's making a difference. And of course, that's exactly what More Place is. And that's why Dale and all of the staff and the board of the Urban Ministry Center should be so proud, and Charlotte should be so proud. And as you mentioned, it's 10% of the population. We still got 90% to go. And that's exactly why a plan, a 10-year plan, is so necessary, that's shaped around business principles and practices. Dust off the old plan that we shaped in 2006, and let's get that plan recalibrated. There's a housing coalition that's now been created in Charlotte to do exactly that. And those good folk, led by Mike Reiser of Wells Fargo, they're going to recalibrate that plan using business principles and practices. And the exact idea of that plan, the first priority of that plan will be the other 90% are still out there. And it's those plans that are making a difference in cities exactly the same size as Charlotte. In fact, just today, Denver, Colorado, which is about the exact same size as Charlotte, after 5 years of their plan, they made their five-year announcement today. They've created more than 2,000 units of housing targeted to people experiencing chronic homelessness. And they're right on track because they've actually eliminated 60% of chronic homelessness in Denver through the implementation of their plan.
I, until yesterday, had never heard of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness that you led in the Bush administration mm-hmm. and for the first 100 days of the Obama mm-hmm. administration. When you were appointed to that position, was this a new agency, or it was a new aid? So it was created by the Bush administration?
It actually had gone dormant in the previous administration. It was dormant for about 6 years. And President Bush, basically as part of his larger idea of not leaving people behind, whether it was kids in school uh-huh. or people who had AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, or people in disadvantaged areas who needed health clinics. This was part of that larger, I think some people termed it compassionate conservatism, but the intent of revitalizing the U.S. Interagency Council was to create the kind of strategy, understanding that federal resources weren't just funding, they needed to be an investment, and they needed to create results. So we took that message to mayors and county executives all across our country. I think the good news here in Charlotte is you have a mayor in Anthony Fox who is very committed to this issue, and he understands that the old school methods just haven't worked. We wish they did. We wish that moral and spiritual had driven us to eliminate the issue. It's only gotten worse. So he's now ready, as well as your city and the business community leaders in your city, are ready to adopt that kind of strategy.
I think a lot of people would be surprised by this, are being surprised by this morning. They talk about how President Obama has had a communication problem over the last 2 years getting his message out. This is a message I don't think that got out under the Bush administration, because as I said, unless I've just lived in a cloud someplace, I'd never heard of that agency before. But federal spending on homelessness in the Bush administration increased to record levels.
It went from about $2 billion when President Bush... In fact, I said before I left Massachusetts, I said, look, if spending on homelessness doesn't increase in every year, I can't come because I'm going out asking mayors and county executives and governors to partner with us. But if we're decreasing the money, there's no credibility in that. So I had an assurance that every year, and it increased from $2 billion when the year that President Bush was elected, to more than $5 billion when he left. But the critical thing in that was new resources are important, but new ideas on how to use those resources are important. So it's that shift from simply funding programs that we had nostalgia for to investing in innovative ideas that actually accomplished the purposes. And while you might not heard of it, Mike, actually, you could talk to just about any mayor in this country, and they would be very familiar, or any county executive, or any governor. And that was really our constituency and the business community as well. We needed to reshape and reframe homelessness policy, which we did. And that's why literally all across our country, coast to coast, border to border, cities are seeing reductions of the number of people on their streets. And that's the future here in Charlotte as well.
Let me flip that coin over. Because when President Bush was in office, it was a different world economically. And today we've just gone through an election in which a lot of candidates and a lot of voters were decrying big government and big government spending. And you increased spending on homelessness, of all things, from $2 to over $5 billion a year. Is that another instance of overinflated, wasteful government spending?
If there were no results from that, if you could not identify visible, measurable, quantifiable results in the life of the community, then it would have been an enormous waste. But, in fact, in cities all over our country, whether it's New York or San Francisco or Dallas or St. Louis or Denver and soon in Charlotte, the numbers of people on the streets started decreasing. And why that's important in the local community, as Carolyn and the people at Urban Ministries know, is that, again, as we said earlier, homeless people who look like they're just lying on the street, they're actually very expensive in the community. So not only are you investing in the result of ending people's homelessness, there are cost savings that accrue locally in hospital emergency rooms and police and fire departments. And that's what's driving and sustaining political will on the issue.
That $5 billion saw the first documented national decrease in homelessness, a 30% decrease in street and chronic homelessness, and a 12% overall decrease in just 2 years, 2005 to 2007. So put those numbers into perspective. Is that a good return on investment?
I don't think there's any question on this issue, where all we saw previously were the numbers going up for the first time in the history of our country. In fact, that reduction in those 2 years that you mentioned of 52,000 people off the streets of our country into housing, as far as we know, that's the largest reduction in homelessness ever documented by research and data. And actually, in the succeeding couple of years, that number has actually increased. Even with the bad economics, that number is up to about 39% reduction. And since it's Veterans Day, I think it's very important to mention as well, just yesterday, Secretary Shinseki, who is the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and the First Lady, Michelle Obama, announced yet another new program targeted at the lives of homeless veterans and their families to reduce that further. And veterans homelessness, here's good news and bad news on veterans homelessness on this day. Not too many years ago, the number of veterans on the streets and in the shelters of our country was at 175,000 on any given night. That it was actually at 195,000 about 10 years ago. That number is now 107,000, and the trajectory on that number is down, down, down. It's still a national disgrace, of course, that people who have served our country are homeless. That's just horrible. A failure of what we've been doing. But since we put in a new strategy, the number of veterans on our streets suffering from homelessness, that number is going down. And that's some good news on this Veterans Day.
I want to bring that number to Charlotte in just a second. We have to take a break, and we will talk about the number of homeless veterans that are here. I see them on street corners every night when I go home, as a matter of fact, with signs. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at First Citizens Bank, dedicated to helping small business owners succeed by understanding them, their business, and their vision. 1-866-FCB-4BIZ. And the surgical weight loss program at Fry Regional Medical Center, with a history of over 1,700 patients and more than 150,000 pounds lost. For information, 828-315-4BIZ. 3391. Taking care of veterans now and in years past, the history of services for veterans and the challenges of meeting the complex physical and psychological needs of the men and women coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. An appropriate topic on this Veterans Day on the Diane Rehm Show. That's coming up in about 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE and WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
With the holiday season approaching, you can reach the Charlotte area's most affluent and discerning customers by becoming a WFAE business sponsor. Your company's on-air messages will bring you in contact with a most desirable audience and give you the valuable recognition that comes from supporting a respected public service. Learn more about how WFAE can help your business grow by emailing underwriting@WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and in our Spirit Square seated today, Philip Mangano is president and CEO of American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness and the former director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness in the Bush administration. Carolyn Chambray is director of More Place and the Homeless to Homes Housing Program at Urban Ministry Center. And just prior to the break, we were talking about the problem of homeless veterans. It's a national disgrace. It's a national disgrace that these guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan have to fight for benefits, medical benefits. And I'm sure that that's part of the reason that there are so many homeless vets, but there, a lot of them are from the Vietnam era and in other conflicts as well. But the idea that we have people who potentially put their lives on the line out there panhandling is a disgrace. How many homeless vets have you identified in Charlotte?
When we did the vulnerability index of the 807 chronically homeless that we identified, 15% of those were veterans, which is a staggering.
And why are they homeless? Do we know?
I don't think the reasons are that dissimilar from the general chronic homeless population. They suffer from a lot of the same issues that Philip talked about. Could be substance abuse, could be mental health issues, could be both dual diagnosis combined with some physical health issues. So I don't think the reasons are necessarily very dissimilar from the general homeless.
A lot of people say, well, why should I give them anything? Not just the vets sitting mm-hmm. up, but anybody who's panhandling. Why? Because there are social services networks that are set up in every city in this country to help these people. There are soup kitchens. There are places to stay overnight. Why should I help? Just if I give them money, they're going to use it on something that they shouldn't be using it on.
Right.
Is that true? If these people wanted to come off the street for the night, if they need a meal, if they need a new pair of pants or a new pair of shoes, can they get it from the social services network, either the faith-based organizations or the non-governmental organizations or the government itself?
They can. They can get it. And so I think when people say that, I think that that's true, that in Charlotte especially, we have an extraordinarily generous community, and there are soup kitchens, and there are places to get clothing.
So why are they on the street panhandling?
I think that we have not been, we're not asking the right questions and we're not offering the right solutions. It goes back to what Philip said. And I think for many of the chronically homeless, the ability to think long term, to think about something like housing and having something like a place to go and a key, as we talked about earlier, is something that they're thinking about survival. They're in basic survival mode. They're not in long term, thinking long term about beyond that. So I think it's a failure partly on our part to provide and to offer the right mm-hmm. services, and that being housing with services attached.
And the fact is that panhandling, there have been studies done in cities. In Denver, they did a study. They learned that over the course of a year, panhandlers got $4 million. Wherever you put $4 million, there are going to be people going after that $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the approach that Denver took was, because, in fact, there's not one shred of evidence, no data, no research that says that giving money randomly to homeless people does anything to impact their life in a positive way. Not one shred of evidence. But there is an enormous amount of evidence, data and research now, that tells us that building something like More Place does, in fact, impact on the homeless person, impact on the community, impact on the taxpayer. So part of what we need to do, and part of what they did in Denver, was they did a public service campaign to help people understand that giving randomly doesn't necessarily help, but investing in initiatives does help. And they actually created, they took some old parking meters, they refurbished the parking meters so that, in fact, if you were on the street and you were confronted by a homeless person, you, of course, treat them with dignity, but you put the money in the parking meter, which you're assured every single penny of that is going to go to creating an initiative that will help solve that person's homelessness, rather than, again, giving it randomly to people, which you don't know what it's being used for. And again, there's no data and research that says that that actually helps the homeless person. If we are acting still in the old school of conjecture and anecdote about homelessness, maybe you would give money to people on the street. But we've had to shift that to data and research. What actually does work? After 20 years of things not working, we finally know there are innovative ideas that work. Housing first, rapid rehousing, permanent supportive housing, other kinds of engagement techniques that work. We should be investing not only our individual money, but government and business should invest only in what the data and research tells us works. We've had 20 years of empirical data on what doesn't work. Mm. We now have about 10 years of data on what does work. Let's only invest in what's working.
You dealt with this in New York City, which obviously they have it's a bigger city, so they have a much bigger problem with this. Are there any lessons that you learned there that you're applying here that we can learn from here, that we are learning from here?
I think that New York, one thing that helped New York is I think that New York got really smart about data and really used the data to drive what it was doing. And so I think that Charlotte has applied that with the Vulnerability Index. I think in New York, you know, for a long time, it was exactly what Philip talked about. It was pouring money into these solutions. New York could boast the Bellevue Men's Shelter had 850 beds and would boast as if that was something to be proud about. It were pouring money into something that wasn't a solution. It was a stopgap. Mm-hmm. And once they started to get really smart about data, about really knowing who was their homeless population, who were the chronically homeless, how many were veterans, how many were seniors, and how to align those resources with those populations, it started to make a dent. And I think that's what we're doing with Charlotte, and that was the purpose of doing the Vulnerability Index.
We've been talking a lot about the chronically homeless, and I hope these figures are correct, because if they're not, the question is invalid. But I'm told that the chronically homeless create a bottleneck in the system because they make up 10% mm-hmm. of the population of the homeless, and yet they use 50% of the resources. And it seems in this conversation, at least, we've been targeting everything toward the chronically homeless. Is that true, first of all? And secondly, if it is true, is it because we need to break the bottleneck?
The data and research tell us, again, exactly what you said, that somewhere between 10 and 20% of the people who are experiencing chronic homelessness, that is, of the total population, they are about 10 to 20%, and they consume a disproportionate amount of the resources. It just makes sense. The person who's the most sick consumes more resources in the hospital than the person who isn't. So that makes a lot of sense. So they do create a certain kind of bottleneck in that they stay in shelters a long time or they're out on the streets for a long time, and they consume not only a disproportionate amount of resources committed to homelessness, but a disproportionate amount of community resources in terms of emergency room visits. As Carolyn reported, you've seen people right here in Charlotte, but it's true all across the country, all across the world, that these folk absorb a disproportionate amount of emergency room stays, police time, firefighter time, and all of that. But I wanted to go back for one second to what you were talking about in New York. I know in the country there's nothing more dismissible than what happens in New York. People always find a reason you can't replicate what happened in New York. And I can understand, I'm a Bostonian, so I have a certain prejudice against New York anyway, but the reality is when you talk about New York programs in the rest, most of the country, they appreciate what happened, but they think that they can't replicate it. The good news for Charlotte as it moves forward to recalibrate its plan and as it moves forward with innovative ideas is that there are cities exactly the same size as Charlotte, cities like Seattle, in Denver, in Atlanta, who have put into place the kind of planning and the kind of innovative ideas. And Charlotte, rather than reinventing the wheel, rather than going back to ground zero and having to discover everything new, they can look at those 10-year plans, find the innovative ideas that are working. I especially encourage, frankly, a pilgrimage. And I talked to Dale, who's the executive director of Urban Ministries, last night. I said, you got to get a foundation who will create a pilgrimage that goes to Denver to see what's happening in Denver. You could do it to Seattle. You could do it to Atlanta. But going to Denver, where not only have they mobilized the political will and civic will. They've mobilized the faith communities. And, of course, this one of the many names of Charlotte is the City of Churches. They, in Denver, have mobilized the faith communities to move away from the old drive-by feeding programs where you drive by, you feed people, and then you leave, and the people are still out there on the streets.
Right.
They've mobilized the faith community to become part of the solution, to be part of the housing effort in Denver. That would be a great model for the tremendous intent and support that comes from churches to move them from the old charitable response to something that's solution-oriented.
And again, we're talking about the chronically homeless here, but the economy is terrible at the moment, and you have said that the numbers of situationally homeless people, these are people who are losing their homes because of foreclosure, et cetera, are increasing alarmingly. So how is this impacting what you have to do to provide services?
Well, just on the national level, and then Carolyn can talk locally. There's no question that the number of people experiencing chronic homelessness by virtue of 10-year plans and innovative ideas, that's dropping all across our country. There's been almost a 40% decrease in the last several years. But the number of homeless families in our country has increased because it's the double trouble of the economy, foreclosures and job loss. Well, that's a perfect storm to create vulnerability in families and to cascade them into homelessness. But it's the same principles that are working for the chronic homeless that can work for family homelessness. That is, put business ideas and business principles, look at what's happening and understand how to reallocate resources to target them. To the credit of the Obama administration, and during that first 100 days I was there, it was the stimulus package, which is much maligned and there are pros and cons about it. But in that stimulus package, there were $2 billion targeted to homeless people. $1.5 billion of that at HUD was targeted to both prevent people from falling into homelessness who were victims of that double trouble and to create rapid rehousing strategies targeted to families. So it was both to prevent and rapidly end. That $1.5 billion has literally resulted in tens of thousands of families around our country who would have otherwise fallen into homelessness. Mm-hmm. They were prevented or rapidly rehoused. And I know in Charlotte there's been a good investment of those resources.
There has. Yeah, the Project Hope program has been doing exactly that, using these federal stimulus dollars to rapidly rehouse people. I think another thing that's really unique about the Project Hope project in Charlotte, and something that speaks to the uniqueness of Charlotte, is the support services that are provided. Philip gave the example of another city that uses volunteers in the community, and that's what Project Hope does, is they use Hope teams and are made up of community members. So they provide those key essential services to help people stay housed.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a couple of calls, and I'll read you a couple of emails that have come in over the last several minutes. Mike, in Charlotte, you're on WFAE. Welcome. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, this is Frank Mansfield.
Oh, Frank, I'm sorry. It said Mike on the screen here. So, Frank, go ahead.
Oh. I wanted to join the conversation. I'm currently working. Formerly, I'm the director of the Uptown Shelter, now the Men's Shelter of Charlotte, and former chairman of the Homeless Services Network in Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
We have made tremendous strides in homeless services and in collaboration efforts in the community, and I just wanted to support that along the lines of what your guests have been saying. I also work currently at McCreesh Place, St. Peter's Homes Incorporated. McCreesh Place is another supported housing program in Charlotte. We have 62 chronically homeless men, and living in SRO-type supported housing, and are just before constructing 27 efficiency apartments in a collaboration with Charlotte Housing Authority. So we are increasing the resources, and I just wanted to support
All
what
right.
Carolyn had said about adding housing is the solution.
All right. Frank, thank you for your call. We have an email here from Deanna who says, how much do health care costs decline after a homeless person has been given housing? Without insurance, the ER is still primary care.
Well, as I mentioned, literally in studies around the country, it drops anywhere from $35,000 to $150,000 in a variety of different services. Most of those services are in the ER or in the emergency room. So in the cost, what are called cost-benefit analysis, that is, you do an intervention and you find out how much it costs the year after the intervention and how much did it cost before the intervention. What we've seen in city after city across the United States is that the costs associated with emergency room visits drop precipitously, because once a person is stable in the security and safety of housing, and some people want to bifurcate between housing and services. I say housing is the most important service, and then you wrap all the services that a person needs. You can deliver those services more effectively and more efficiently when a person's stable in housing than you can when they're randomly ricocheting. So there are very dramatic cost decreases in emergency rooms, in police interventions, in firefighter interventions, in court and incarceration costs, not to mention in acute substance abuse and mental health situations. That's where the cost efficiencies are. That's why, again, initiatives like More Place, better for the homeless person, because finally we're providing what the homeless person wanted, a place to live, better for the community, it's more healthy, and better for the taxpayer because you save money.
And you say housing is health care.
Housing is health care. Once people move into housing, they're no longer dependent on the ER as their primary care, because part of the goal with the supportive services is getting that person hooked up with a medical home. So getting them hooked up with a place that they have a primary care physician and they're no longer using the ER. And we've seen that with our homeless to homes, the 12 people who we have in housing now all now have a dedicated healthcare provider.
Very quickly, because I have a minute left, we have a lot of emails here and comments from people who basically are saying somewhat the same thing. And one of them says, Charlotte's problem, finding a job with enough hours and a living wage and then finding an affordable place to live. Charlotte has too many luxury homes and not enough well-kept affordable homes. This person has been homeless or is now homeless. There was no way I was going to live in a project. We have a lot of people have commented on the web and on emails saying that they are now or have been homeless in Charlotte.
And I think that just underscores, I mean, if I could say one thing to bring it home to sort of the layperson in the community about homelessness, it's not an us versus them issue. And I've met more people in my work doing this that say, my cousin is homeless. I have an uncle who struggled with homelessness, struggled with alcohol abuse, and that led to long-term homelessness. It's not an us versus them issue. And I think people realize that.
Carolyn Chambray is director of More Place and the Homeless to Homes Housing Program with Urban Ministry Center here in Charlotte. And Philip Mangano is president and CEO of the American Roundtable to Abolish Homelessness. Thank you both for being here. Thanks for the hour.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you.
Good being with you.